Part 1 Chapter 1 Ramon Espejo lifted his chin, daring his opponent to strike. The crowd that filled the alleyway behind the ramshackle bar called the El Rey formed a ring, bodies pressing against each other in the tension between coming close enough to see and retreating to a safe distance. Their voices were a mixture of shouts, urging the two men to fight, and weak, insincere exhortations to make peace. The big man, bobbing and weaving across the narrow circle from him, was a pale European, his cheeks flushed red from liquor, his wide, soft hands balled into fists. He was taller than Ramon, with a greater reach. Ramon could see the man's eyes shifting, as wary of the crowd as of Ramon. "Come on, pendejo," Ramon said, grinning. His arms were raised and spread as if he were ready to embrace the fighter. "You wanted power? Come, have a taste of it." The shifting LEDs of the bar's signs turned the night blue and red and amber in turn. Far above them all, the night sky shone with countless stars, too bright and too close for the lights of Diego Town to drown. The constellation of the Stone Man stared down at them as they circled, a single star smoldering balefully like a red eye, as if it was watching, as if it was urging them on. "I ought to do it, you ugly little greaser," the European spat. "I ought to go ahead and kick your skinny ass." Ramon only bared his teeth and motioned the man nearer. The European wanted this to be a talking fight again, but it was too late for that. The voices of the crowd merged into a single waterfall roar. The European made his move, graceless as a falling tree. The great left fist made its slow way through the air, moving as though through molasses. Ramon stepped inside the swing, letting the gravity knife slip from his sleeve into his hand. He flicked the blade open in the same motion that brought his fist against the larger man's belly. A look of almost comical surprise crossed the European's face. His breath went out of him with a whoof. Ramon stabbed twice more, fast and hard, twisting the knife just to be sure. He was close enough to smell the nose-tingling reek of the flowery cologne the man wore, to feel his licorice-scented breath panting against his face. The crowd went silent as the European slipped to his knees, and then sat, legs spread. In the filthy muck of the alley, the big, soft hands opened and closed aimlessly, slick with blood that turned pale when the LEDs were red, black when the light shifted blue. The European's mouth gaped open, and blood gushed out over his teeth. Slowly, very slowly, seeming to move in slow motion, he toppled sideways to the ground, kicked his feet, heels drumming the ground, was still. Someone in the crowd uttered an awed obscenity. Ramon's shrill, self-satisfied pleasure faded. He looked at the faces of the crowd, wide eyes, mouths open in little surprised O's. The alcohol in his blood seemed to thin, sobriety floating to the top of his mind. A sinking sense of betrayal possessed him. These people had been pushing him on, encouraging the fight, and now they were abandoning him for winning it? "What?" Ramon shouted to the other patrons of the El Rey. "You heard what he was saying. You saw what he did." But the alley was emptying. Even the woman who'd been with the European, the one who had started it all, was gone. Mikel Ibrahim, the manager of the El Rey, lumbered toward him, his great bear-like face the image of patient, saintly suffering. He held out his wide hand. Ramon lifted his chin again, thrust out his chest, as if Mikel's gesture was an insult. The manager only sighed, and shook his head slowly back and forth, and made a pulling gesture with his fingers. Ramon curled his lip, half turned away, then slapped the handle of the knife into the waiting palm. "Police are coming," the manager warned. "You should go home, Ramon."
"You saw what happened," Ramon said.
"No, I wasn't here when it happened," Mikel said. "And neither were you, eh? Now go home, and keep your mouth shut." Ramon spat on the ground and stalked into the night. It wasn't until he began to walk that he understood how drunk he was. At the canal by the plaza, he squatted down, leaned back against a tree, and waited until he was sure he could walk without listing. Around him, Diego Town spent its week's wages on alcohol and cafakit and sex. Music tumbled in from the rough gypsy houseboats on the canal, fast, festive accordion mixing with trumpets and steel drums and the shouts of the dancers. Somewhere in the darkness, a tenfin was calling mournfully, a bird that was really a flying lizard and sounded uncannily like a woman sobbing in misery and despair. Something that had led the superstitious Mexican peasants who made up a large percentage of the colony's population to say that La Llorona, the crying woman, had crossed the stars with them from Mexico, and now wandered the night of this new planet, crying not only for all the children who'd been lost and left behind on Earth, but for all the ones who would die on this hard new world. He, of course, didn't believe in such crap. But as the ghostly crying accelerated to a heartbreaking crescendo, he couldn't help but shiver. Alone, Ramon could regret stabbing the European. Surely it would have been enough just to punch him around, humiliate him, slap him like a bitch. But when Ramon was drunk and angry, he always went too far. Ramon knew that he shouldn't have drunk so much, and that whenever he got around people, it always seemed to end like this. He'd begun this evening with the sick knot in his belly, which being in the city seemed to bring. And then, by the time he'd drunk enough to untie that knot, as usual, someone had said or done something to enrage him. It didn't always end with a knife, but it rarely ended well. Ramon didn't like it, but he wasn't ashamed of it either. He was a man, an independent prospector on a tough frontier colony world less than a generation removed from its founding. By God, he was a man. He drank hard, he fought hard, and anyone who had a problem with that would be wise to keep their pinche opinions to themselves. A family of tapanos, small, raccoon-like amphibians with scales like a hedgehog's spikes, lumbered up from the water, considered Ramon with dark, shining eyes, and made their way toward the plaza, where they would scavenge for the dropped food and trash of the day. Ramon watched them pass, slick, dark paths of canal water trailing behind them, then sighed and hauled himself to his feet. Elena's apartment was in the maze of streets around the Palace of the Governors. It perched above a butcher's shop, and the air that came in from the back window was often fetid with old gore. He considered sleeping in his van, but he felt sticky and exhausted. He wanted a shower and a beer and a plate of something warm to keep his belly from growling. He climbed the stairs slowly, trying to be quiet, but the lights were burning in her windows. A shuttle was lifting from the spaceport far to the north, tracking lights glowing blue and red as the vessel rose toward the stars. Ramon tried to cover the click and hiss of the door with the throbbing rumble of the shuttle's lift drive, but it was no use. "Where the fuck have you been?" Elena yelled as he stepped inside. She wore a thin cotton dress with a stain on the sleeve. Her hair was tied back into a knot of black, darker than the sky. Her teeth were bared in rage, her mouth almost square with it. Ramon closed the door behind him and heard her gasp. In an instant, the anger had left her. He followed her gaze to where the European's blood had soaked the side of his shirt, the leg of his pants. He shrugged. "We'll have to burn these," he said.
"Are you okay, mi hijo? What happened?"
He hated it when she called him that. He was no one's little boy. But it was better than fighting. So he smiled, pulling at the tongue of his belt. "I'm fine," he said. "It was the other cabron who took the worst of it."
"The police? Will the police—"
"Probably not," Ramon said, dropping his pants around his knees. He pulled his shirt up over his head. "Still, we should burn these." She asked no more questions. only took his clothes out to the incinerator that the apartments on the block all shared, while Ramon took a shower. The time readout in the mirror told him that dawn was still 3 or 4 hours away. He stood under the flow of warm water, considering his scars. The wide white band on his belly where Martin Casals had slashed him with a sheet metal hook. The disfiguring lump below his elbow where some drunken bastard had almost sheared through his bones with a machete. Old scars. Some older than others. They didn't bother him. In fact, he liked them. They made him look strong. When he came out, Elena was standing at her back window, arms crossed below her breasts. When she turned to him, he was ready for the blast furnace of her rage. But instead, her mouth was a tiny rosebud, her eyes wide and round. When she spoke, she sounded like a child. Worse, like a woman trying to be a child.
"I was scared for you," she said.
"You never have to be," he said. "I'm tough as leather."
"But you're just one man," she said. "When Tomas Martinez got killed, there were 8 men. They came right up to him when he came out of his girlfriend's house, and—"
"Tomas was a little whore," Ramon said, and waved a hand dismissively, as if to say that any real man ought to be able to stand up against 8 thugs sent to even a score. Elena's lips relaxed into a smile, and she walked toward him, her hips shifting forward with each step, as if her pussy were coming to him, the rest of her trailing behind reluctantly. It could have gone the other way, he knew. They could as easily have passed the night, as they had so many others, shouting at each other, throwing things, coming to blows. But even that might have ended in sex, and he was tired enough that he was genuinely grateful they could simply fuck and then sleep, and forget about the wasted, empty day that had just gone by. Elena lifted off her dress. Ramon took her familiar flesh in his arms. The scent of old blood rose from the butcher's shop below like an ugly perfume of earth and humanity that had followed them across the void. Afterward, Ramon lay spent in the bed. Another shuttle was lifting off. Usually there was hardly more than one a month, but the Enya were coming soon, earlier than expected, and the platform above Diego Town needed to be fitted out to receive the great ships with their alien cargoes. It was generations ago that mankind had raised itself up from the gravity wells of Earth and Mars and Europa and taken to the stars with dreams of conquest. Humanity had planned to spread its seed through the universe like a high counselor's son at a port town brothel. But it had been disappointed. The universe was already taken. Other star-faring races had been there before them. Dreams of empire faded into dreams of wealth. Dreams of wealth decayed into shamed wonder. More than the great and enigmatic technologies of the Silver Enya and Turu, it was the nature of space itself that defeated them, as it had defeated every other star-faring race. The vast dark was too great. Too big. Communication at the speed of light was so slow as to barely be communication at all. Governance was impossible. Law beyond what could be imposed locally was farcical. The outposts of the commercial alliance that humanity had been persuaded to join by the Silver Enya, much as Admiral Perry's gunships had persuaded Japan to open itself up for trade in a much earlier generation, were wide-flung, some outposts falling out of contact for generations, some lost and forgotten, or else put on a bureaucrat's schedule of concerns to be addressed another generation hence by another bureaucrat, as yet unborn. Establishing dominance, or even much continuity, across that gaping infinity of night, was something that seemed possible only from the provincially narrow viewpoint imposed by looking up from the bottom of a gravity well. Once you got out among the stars, you learned better. No race had been able to overcome such vast distance, and so they had striven to overcome time. And it was in this that humanity at last found some small niche in the crowded, chaotic darkness of the universe. Enya and Turu saw the damage done by humanity to its own environment, the deeply human propensity for change and control, and the profoundly limited ability to see ahead to consequences, and they had found it more virtue than vice. The vast institutional minds, human and alien both, entered into a glacially slow generational agreement. Where empty planets were, intractable and inconvenient and dangerous, with wild flora and unknown fauna, there humans would be put. For the slow decades or centuries that it required to tame, to break, to pave over whatever marvels and threats evolution had put there, the Silver Enya and Sian and Turu and whatever other great races happened by would act as trade ships once had in the ancient days when mankind had displaced itself from the small islands and insignificant hills of Earth. The Sao Paulo colony was barely in its second generation. There were women still alive who could recall the initial descent onto an untouched world. Diego Town, Nueva Janeiro, San Esteban, Amadora, Little Dog, Fiddler's Jump. All the cities of the South had bloomed since then, like mold on a petri dish. Men had died from the subtle toxins of the native foods. Men had discovered the great cat lizards, soon nicknamed chupacabras after the mythical goat-suckers of old Earth, that had stood proud and dumb at the peak of the planet's food chain, and men had died for their discovery. The oyster-eyed Silver Enya had not. The insect and glass Turu had not. The enigmatic Sian, with their penchant for weightlessness, had not. And now the great ships were coming ahead of schedule. Each half-living ship, heavy, they all assumed, with new equipment and people from other colonies, hoping to make a place for themselves here, on Sao Paulo. And also rich with the chance of escape for those to whom the colony had become a prison. More than one person had asked Ramon if he'd thought of going up, out, into the darkness. But they had misunderstood him. He had been in space. He had come here. The only attraction that leaving could hold was the chance to be someplace with even fewer people, which was unlikely. However ill he fit in Sao Paulo, he could imagine no situation less odious. He didn't recall falling asleep, but woke when the late morning sun streaming through Elena's window shone on his face. He could hear her humming in the next room, going about the business of her morning. "Shut up, you evil bitch," he thought, wincing at the flash of a lingering hangover. She had no talent for song. Every note she made was flat and grating. Ramon lay silent, willing himself back to sleep, away from this city, this irritating noise, this woman, this moment in time. Then the humming was drowned by an angry sizzling sound, and a moment later, the scent of garlic and chili sausage and frying onions wafted into the room. Ramon was suddenly aware of the emptiness in his belly. With a sigh, he raised himself to his elbow, swung his sleep-sodden legs around, and, stumbling awkwardly, made his way to the doorway. "You look like shit," Elena said. "I don't know why I even let you in my house. Don't touch that. That's my breakfast. You can go earn your own." Ramon tossed the sausage from hand to hand, grinning, until it cooled enough to take a bite. "I work 50 hours a week to make the credit. And what do you do?" Elena demanded. "Loaf around in the Terreno Cimarron, come into town to drink whatever you earn. You don't even have a bed of your own." "Is there coffee?" Ramon asked. Elena gestured with her chin toward the worn plastic and chitin thermos on the kitchen counter. Ramon rinsed a tin cup and filled it with yesterday's coffee. "I'll make my big find," he said. "Uranium or tantalum. I'll make enough money that I won't have to work again for the rest of my life." "And then you'll throw me out and get some young puta from the docks to follow you around. I know what men are like." Ramon filched another sausage from her plate. She slapped the back of his hand hard enough to sting. "There's a parade today," Elena said. "After the blessing of the fleet, the governor's making a big show to beam out to the Enya. Make them think we're all so happy that they came early. There's going to be dancing and free rum.
The Enya think we're trained dogs, Ramon said, around a mouthful of sausage.
Hard lines appeared at the corner of Elena's mouth. Her eyes went cold.
I think it would be fun, she said, thin venom in her tone.
Ramon shrugged. It was her bed he was sleeping in. He'd always known there was a price for its use.
I'll get dressed, he said, and swilled down the last of the coffee.
I've got a little money. It can be my treat. They skipped the blessing of the fleet. Ramon had no interest in hearing priests droning mumbo-jumbo bullshit while pouring dippers of holy water on beaten-up fishing boats. But they'd arrived in time for the parade that followed. The main street that ran past the palace of the governors was wide enough for 5 hauling trucks to drive abreast if they stopped traffic coming the other way. Great floats moved slowly, often stopping for minutes at a time. With secular subjects, a Turu spacecraft, studded with lights, being pulled by a team of horses. A plastic chupacabra with red glowing eyes and a jaw that opened and closed to show the great teeth made from old pipes, mixing with oversized displays of Jesus, Bob Marley, and the Virgin of Despegando Station. Here came a twice-life-sized satirical, recognizable but very unflattering, caricature of the governor. Huge lips pursed as if ready to kiss the silver Enyas's asses, and a ripple of laughter went down the street. The first wave of colonists, the ones who had named the planet Sao Paulo, had been from Brazil, and although few, if any, of them had ever been to Portugal, they were universally referred to as the Portuguese by the Spanish-speaking colonists, mostly Mexicans, who had arrived with the second and third waves. The Portuguese still dominated the upper-level positions in local government and administration, and the highest-paying jobs, and were widely resented and disliked by the Spanish-speaking majority, who felt they'd been made into second-class citizens in their own new home. A chorus of boos and jeers followed the huge float of the governor down the street. Musicians followed the great lumbering floats. Steel bands, string bands, mariachi bands, tuck bands, marching units of zouaves, strolling guitarists playing fado music, stilt walkers and tumbling acrobats, young women in half-finished carnival costumes danced along like birds. With Elena at his side, Ramon was careful not to look at their half-exposed breasts, or to get caught doing so. The maze of side streets was packed full. Coffee stands and rum sellers, bakers offering frosted pastry red jackets and chupacabras, food carts selling fried fish and tacos, satay and jug-jug, sideshow buskers, street artists, fire eaters, 3-card Monty dealers, all were making the most of the improvised festival. For the first hour, it was almost enjoyable. After that, the constant noise and press and scent of humanity all around him made Ramon edgy. Elena was her infant girl self, squealing in delight like a child and dragging him from one place to another, spending his money on candy rope and sugar skulls. He managed to slow her slightly by buying real food, a waxed paper cone of saffron rice, hot peppers and strips of roasted butterfin flesh, and a tall, thin glass of flavored rum, and by picking a hill in the park nearest the palace where they could sit on the grass and watch the great, slow river of people slide past them. Elena was sucking the last of the spice from her fingertips and leaning against him, her arm around him like a chain, when Patricio Gallegos caught sight of them and came walking up the rise. His gait had a hitch in it from when he'd broken his hip in a rock slide. Prospecting wasn't a safe job. Ramon watched him approach.
"Hey," Patricio said. "How's it going, eh?"
Ramon shrugged as best he could, with Elena clinging to him like ivy on a brick.
"You?" Ramon asked.
Patricio wagged a hand. "Not good, not bad.
I've been surveying mineral salts on the south coast for one of the corporations. It's a pain in the ass, but they pay regular. Not like being an independent.
You do what you gotta do, Ramon said, and Patricio nodded as if he'd said something particularly wise. On the street, the chupacabra float was turning slowly, the great idiot mouth champing at the air. Patricio didn't leave. Ramon shielded his eyes from the sun and looked up at him.
What? Ramon said.
You hear about the ambassador from Europa? Patricio said. He got in a fight last night at the El Rey. Some crazy pendejo stabbed him with a bottleneck or something.
Yeah?
Yeah. He died before they could get him to the hospital. The governor's real pissed off about it.
So what are you telling me for? Ramon asked. I'm not the governor.
Elena was still as stone beside him, her eyes narrow in an expression of low cunning. Ramon quietly willed Patricio to go away, or at least to shut up, but the man didn't pick up on it.
The governor's all busy with the Enya ships coming in. Now he has to track down the guy that killed the ambassador and show how the colony is able to keep the law and all. I've got a cousin who works for the chief constable. It's ugly over there.
Okay, Ramon said.
I was just thinking, you know, you hang out at the El Rey sometimes.
Not last night, Ramon said, glowering. You can ask Miquel if you want. I wasn't there all night.
Patricio smiled and took an awkward step back. The chupacabra made a weak, synthesized roar, and the crowd around it shrilled with laughter and applause.
Yeah, okay, Patricio said. I was just thinking, you know.
And with the conversation trailing away, Patricio smiled, nodded, and limped back down the hill.
It wasn't you, was it? Elena half-whispered, half-hissed. You didn't kill the fucking ambassador.
I didn't kill anyone, and sure as hell not a European. I'm not stupid, Ramon said. Why don't you watch your fucking parade, eh?
Night came on as the parade wound down. At the bottom of the hill, in a field near the palace, they were putting a torch to the pile of wood surrounding Old Man Gloom. Mr. Harding, some of the colonists from Barbados called him, a hastily cobbled-together effigy, almost 20 feet tall, with a face like a grotesque caricature of a European or a Norte Americano, green-painted cheeks and an enormous Pinocchio nose. The bonfire blazed, and wreathed in flames, the giant effigy began to swing its arms and groan in seeming agony. A somehow eerie sight that sent a chill up Ramon's spine, as if he had been given the dubious privilege of watching a soul being tormented in the fires of hell. All the bad luck that dogged people throughout the year was supposed to be burning up with Old Man Gloom, but watching the giant twist and writhe in slow motion in the flames, its deep, electronically amplified moans echoing off the walls of the palace of the governors, Ramon had a glum presentiment that it was his good luck that was burning instead, that from here on in he was headed for nothing but misery and misfortune. And one glance at Elena, who had been sitting silently with her jaw set tight and white lines of anger etched around her mouth ever since he had snapped at her, was enough to tell him that it wasn't going to be very long before that prophecy started to come true.